Today on Deep Thoughts, we're going to talk about getting a job. You know, the climate in the world's changed quite a bit since a lot of us were kids. If you are in a job you don't like and you're looking to find something new, this episode's for you. If you don't have a job and you're like, what the hell am I going to do to pay the bills? This episode's for you. If at any point in your mind during a 24-hour period, you say to yourself, you need a job or a new job, this is for you. Now, let me qualify myself real quickly. I've had some amazing jobs in my lifetime. I think I've only been on one interview in my entire lifetime. I didn't get the job, and that's because I was doing a headhunter a favor at Hitachi. He said, I got to put heads through this place. Go in and do the interview. I don't need you to get the job. I just need you to go through the apparatus for me. And I did. And I wouldn't dare work for those people. But I have been a self-employed person since I was a kid. And I've worked for major corporations since I was a kid. I've had my own company. We grossed over $6 million. I was the CEO and co-founder. When I worked at big companies like Electronic Arts Video Game Company, my team swelled up to 55 people. I've done major negotiations with people like Steve Jobs and other Coke and Pepsi and Starbucks and all these big companies and AOL. So I have been to the very depths of employment, of being employed myself, to taking people and changing their lives forever. Okay. So I can get you where you need to go. Guaranteed. Each one of your paths are going to be different. But what I'm going to cover in this particular episode is helping you get your game ready, help you get your mind ready for the process of being interviewed, and helping you understand who you're talking to on the other side so that you understand empathetically the way they're viewing you. If you don't understand what your employer is thinking, your opportunities are slimmer than if you did. I've always walked in the room understanding at least past perhaps 19, and I've understood the risk that they're trying to assess in me. And as I talk, I was always able to extinguish those risks in their mind. And then I was able to deliver. Because I did have an understanding of the risks that they were concerned about, my performance was related directly to those risks until I was able to just make sure it was sort of muscle memory and those risks were never a problem and I could go off and add my own magic, right? So let's get started. Let's just take a climate update on where we are in the economy right now. If you can be replaced by a robot, 5 to 10 years, you will be replaced by a robot. So any of you are doing service jobs that aren't related to the experience being human to human, meaning if you're fast food, you'll definitely be a robot replaced person within 10 years for sure. McDonald's and all these joints, they're going to be like ATMs that you go up to get your food. And quite frankly, their crappy food will probably be made better by a robot than by a human being. For those of you in five-star cooking experiences, well, they're always going to want the human interaction. So if you're in a blue-collar job, it's time we move you out of that if you can be replaced by a robot. All right? I did a whole episode on thinking in the essay section, which is the audio-only section. Go to mkultraradio.com, search on thinking. Very, very interesting precursor to this episode, which is to say the following. As long as your job is related to thinking in a way that a computer can't be programmed to think, which usually entails a little bit of creativity, then your job's protected and you're in a good career. But before we get into how to get a job, I think it's very important to understand and evaluate the jobs that you have right now so that you understand if there's any longevity in it. In life, we don't want to slip. And by that, I mean we don't want to come up dry on the income for the family, on the income from our own personal destiny, on just anything that's successful to ourselves, right? So it's important that your job actually has a future. unless we change this world, all the jobs are being sucked out, right? Unless somebody fresh gets elected as president that's not attached to these banking cartels that use the Bilderberg Group to install their bought-off leaders, which is pretty much everybody we've had as president since Kennedy, then your jobs are going to be in China, India, Mexico. They're not going to be here. So it's important that as of right now, you view your job and evaluate it based on being replaced by mechanical apparatus. I just want to make that point before we move forward, because you might be trying to get a job that doesn't have a future. And it's okay to get a job that doesn't have a future, just to exploit it to get to the job that you do want. I think that makes sense. But I need you to understand it is absolutely not a joke. And we have to get off on the right foot. Otherwise, everything else I'm about to tell you is going to be sort of useless information. So why get a new job? This is a very important question you have to ask yourself, because it will be the tense by which that you communicate and build your resume. A few good reasons to switch your job is that one, it's that your inner alignment, your inner desires are not being satisfied by your outer job. When I work with every single one of my employees, I pull them aside and I say, who are you? What makes you tick? Why do you get up in the morning? I mean, why do you get up in the morning when you're really excited? Forget how you got up this morning. Let's pick the day that you popped out of that bed the most excited in your life. And then let's build a job that marries those two together, so that when you come to my company to work for me, you pop out of a bed and you're just thrilled to death. Let's get you to that state. Whether or not I got to promote you, whether or not I have to let you go to go to another company, but let's get you to that state. Because everyone deserves euphoria when it comes to what they do for a living. People that just take jobs to pay bills are miserable. They are miserable and their lives are miserable, but they sometimes can't admit it to themselves. So it's important that your job is part of you. But before I go any further, I know what some of you might be thinking. Well, people have to dig ditches. I can tell you right now, I love manual labor. I fucking love it. I love using my hands for something. Doesn't matter if it's a ditch. Doesn't matter if it's a wood voss I've helped turn on a lathe. You can get into every single job. You should see these dudes that pick up my trash here in Huntington Beach. They drive these freaking gigantic machines that grab the trash cans and throw them over the top. I mean, that's like Tonka trucks when you were kids, man, except it's a job. It's kind of cool. And no matter what job you have, you will get tired of it. You will. Believe me, Steven Spielberg got tired of directing films at one point. George Lucas got tired of directing films at one point. Repetition will always exhaust and tire in your mind. So you have to be into the heart of what you're doing to make that outer layer not matter. Back to why you want to change jobs. One reason is that the job you currently have does not pay your bills. You like it, but it doesn't pay your bills. We're going to get into how to increase your pay at the current job that you're in, because there is a trick. And it's so simple that your mind may not be ready for it. It's interesting. But I have helped people get higher salaries at the places they work so many times I've forgotten. And every single time I tell them how to do it, they always kind of look at me like, there's no way it's just that easy. And I say, yeah, it is. If there's any hope of you getting a higher salary, it is. And then they go in and try it almost begrudgingly, and it works. Unless there's no money at the company and it's about to go under, or someone's an asshole, they always get the job. They always get the increase that they're looking for. Now, there's a bunch of surgical reasons why someone needs to get a job that I can't really address in here, because they're too surgical and too unique. You get divorced and your wife takes the kid 3,000 miles away and you got to get a job in the other location. Everything I'm going to say is going to work for that position, that unique thing. But I'm really talking about the conscious decision to say, I got to move on. And it doesn't matter if you have a job, by the way, for 30 years, the same exact job. You don't have to leave if you don't want to. You only need to leave if something's happening at the job that's not working for you. You're not getting paid enough. The other one I like to remind people is that abuse is never tolerable. I've had this opinion myself. And when I told my employer on a couple different occasions, very rarely happens, but on a couple different occasions, I say, look, I'm willing to, you know, roll up my sleeves and, you know, work really, really hard, super duper long hours. And especially when things get tight and people are unhappy. And when you make a video game, you make a game for 2 years. And at the end of that journey, people are not exactly the happiest. But in the end, when it does well and sells well, all is forgotten, right? No harm, no foul sort of thing, right? But sometimes you get into situations where a supervisor or a peer is just being an asshole. They don't have to, but they are being an asshole. And that's when you try to communicate with them to say, everything all right with you? You know? And if they're just dicks, if they're just assholes, and I'll try to give you a story from EA. You got to move around them, and you got to move them out. But that happens very rarely. So hopefully you don't have the situation. But abuse in the office that you work shouldn't be tolerable. Or tolerated, right? Again, it's fairly rare. So that should just set the foundation. Those are some great reasons to move on. But we have tenses by which we have to be careful communicating to the new opportunity about why we're leaving. I think it's no mystery to most of you that going in to look at for a new position at a new company and they ask you why you're leaving the old company, if you say I'm looking for more money, they get worried that your commitment to their quality is no longer there. You're just simply there to get a higher paycheck. So you can never actually say that, even though it's actually an okay reason to get a new job. It is. But there are ways of saying the same exact thing without getting yourself in trouble. And one of the ways of saying that same exact thing is to say, well, you know, I've kind of reached a ceiling at this company and they just simply don't have the opportunities for me to move forward. And all that means is I can't make any more money at this company. But they want you to be hungry, right? So let's get into the reason why someone hires someone in the first place. Someone might say, oh, well, that's really simple. They need someone to help them run their company. That is a dangerously loose definition as to why someone wants to hire you. Here's the specific way to design your empathetic understanding of the person that you're getting the job from. And it goes something like this. And I've never heard anyone else say it like this. This is my little way of looking at it. We only hire people because we want to have duplicates of ourselves. When I became an employer, that finally became crystal clear to me when I had employees. We want duplicates of ourselves. So that might sound interesting at first, but now empathetically live out that idea. If you're looking at someone who's a founder of a company, especially if you're a really small startup and you have the opportunity to meet one of the founders during the interview process, you're talking to someone who's got some serious skills. They have been through a machine that if you haven't started your own company, you may not be able to understand the difficulty of forming a corporation, filing the paperwork, especially if you're in an office, renting the office space, taking on the lease. If there's any employees in the room, amazing efforts to get them in the room. If there's any benefits, like health benefits for the company, it's an amazing process to set up health benefits, to buy the computers to set you up. Starting a company is hardly a trivial thing. And the more established it is by the time you find it, it's pretty amazing for the person that you're talking to if they're involved with having created it. Now, a massive corporation that's been around for 20, 30, 50, 100 years, a little bit different. It's kind of on autopilot, and there's so much revenue coming in. Typically, they just pay professionals to do the job, and no one's really suffering that badly for the process. But the smaller the company and the newer it is, the more exciting the adventure is, and the more amazing it is that it exists in the first place. If they're hiring you, that usually means there's a growth spurt going on in the company. Very rarely are you going to be hired to hopefully save a dying company. That doesn't usually happen. So if you're being hired, if you're being interviewed to be hired, there's a growth surge going on in the company at that exact moment, and they need to quickly expand and quickly find super qualified people to take on very important jobs. And the smaller the company, the more they need to for you to hit the ground running. They want you to own the position and not be supervised. If they duplicated themselves, there'd be no explanation of how the company runs and how they do what they do and what your responsibilities would be. You would simply just, you know, they would simply duplicate themselves and just immediately start working on something. So to the degree you can duplicate that objective in their mind, in the word process, we're going to talk about the whole interview process, building your resume. So everything's in this deep thought, okay? An interview is all about risk assessment. When I used to do interviews at Electronic Arts, where I had to do the most hiring in my entire life, we had I inherited a group of about 6 coders. Then there's a couple resignations, peer resignations in my department, and I gained all the producers. Then I gained all the artists, and being an artist and a producer and a coder myself, man, I was just owning this shit. These people were resigning to hopefully put the pressure on Electronic Arts to give them, to hire them back and give them more money. Stupidest idea on planet Earth. All right, nobody does that. And because I was super skilled at all those jobs and I had done those jobs for years, I just owned it. And so everybody was able to, artists were able to talk to me and communicate with me as an artist, and I was able to communicate back and empower them. Same thing with the producers. Producers had absolutely no training, so they're running around managing projects, and the person that left was hoarding all of the control of the project, so I ended up passing it all out. I wrote a 32-page document on how to be one of the greatest producers on Earth. Handed that out, and guys were killing it. In fact, the guy that was rated the bottom employee ended up becoming the top employee, and he's extremely successful to this day. But he almost got fired the day that I got the job, and I said, I actually had to tell my supervisor, who I became him very shortly after because he also resigned, lay off this guy. I don't think he's been evaluated properly. Let me work with him for a month to see where he is. And the guy ended up taking 5 times the projects of anyone else and killing it. And I mean that quite literally, because everyone else was taking 1, he was taking 5. My coders, they never had anybody manage them at all that knew coding. And so I came in and started just saying, no, this, if you want to do that. And they dug it. It was a peer-to-peer relationship on all 3 levels of the department, right? But when I started doing this interview process, I started understanding how to really do an interview. And it helped me understand the interviews I had taken up to that point. And I want to mention this to you because there's 2 sections to an interview, typically, if you're dealing with someone that knows what they're doing. You can always have rookies that interview you constantly. And, you know, we're actually bred to believe that if we go into an interview and it doesn't work out, that somehow you've failed. And that's bullshit. That is complete bullshit. You're interviewing them as much as they're interviewing you, believe it or not. No matter how desperate you are for new money, no matter how desperate you are to get the job because it looks like it's your destiny, if it doesn't go well because of the person on the other side of the table, then the last thing you want to do is put your life in their hands. Right? Get the job, have them evaluate you, and they don't have the skill sets to do it. I'll tell you a small story very quickly before I get into the 2 different sections of the interview. There was a point in Electronic Arts, and I bounced all around that company like crazy. First, I was a contractor for years and did stuff outside at the same time, and then finally I went full-time. And there was a point where I was working in the internet division, and I thought, well, let me get back into the gaming division because this internet thing is all wonky and AOL's killing us. We had a weird deal with them where they were stopping us from doing what we needed to do. They hated Flash, basically, and Flash was brand new, and the whole world was going Flash and owning the entire gaming market online, and AOL didn't like the fact their installer went back to Flash.com. And so they said, you can't use Flash to make games, and that completely screwed up a $200 million, or actually $300 million venture. So I do this interview. This kid calls me up out of nowhere. Again, I've been at this company for nearly 10 years. And this kid says, oh, well, let me interview you about getting into the gaming world, right? I'm like, dude, I've been in the gaming world before you, but let's see what you had to say. And this kid interviews me, who doesn't have a position in gaming. He just is some weird HR guy. To this day, I don't know where the guy came from. I've never seen him before, and there was very few people in the company. At least I didn't recognize your face, even out of the 1,500 we had in Redwood Shores. And he interviews me sort of in this, he starts out the whole interview in this condescending manner because I come from the internet side of things, right? And he interviews me all about games, but he doesn't really ask me any poignant questions because he doesn't understand the industry himself. And finally, I get to the end of this interview, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, who the fuck is this guy? He's definitely not qualified to be doing this interview. He doesn't understand hardware, technology, art, programming, anything, the economy of a console, which you have a very limited amount of memory, disk space, and there's an economy of how you build a video game on these systems. And finally, he said something like, you know, he didn't think I was qualified for this job. And I was like, I turned around to him. I said, well, how many video games have you made? And he just went blank. And he had to admit that he's never made a video game, never been on a team that made a video game. And I said, look, I've worked on at least half a dozen at this company, let alone the ones I made before I came to this company by myself with my buddy Dan Chang. Like, who the fuck are you, guy? You know? Well, in the end, I could have pursued it up and gotten another interview in the process, but things were changing all over the place, and you know they were laying off people even in the gaming industry. But I just looked at, or in the gaming division of EA, but I just looked at this guy and I said, man, if this guy's anywhere fucking near me in the business, I don't want to be in that business. If it's gotten this bad that this guy who doesn't know a fucking thing about video games is interviewing me and somehow making a decision I don't know how to do what I've already done, I don't want to have anything to do with it, right? So eventually, I took a parachute and left, and within 2 years, I started my own game company. We made a shit ton of cash and made things that you're still running to this day. Two parts of the interview. When you're in an interview, there's two things they need to know about you if they know what they're doing. So you need to be equipped to communicate both these hemispheres of knowledge about yourself. But just before we do that, we're going to talk about a resume in more detail, but I'm going to tell you, your resume is nothing more than the worm on a hook that comes down into the water that lures the fish to bite. You don't need to explain everything in the world in your resume. You don't. You just need to tantalize them with the almost like the cliffhanger of the film of why you're interesting to talk to. You've done all these crazy things. You want to make sure it's balanced and cool. But that's just to get you in. You have to build the process because people overwrite their resumes to answer all the questions. You don't want to do that. You want to tantalize them with accomplishments and responsibility. You want to show longevity. And that gets you into the interview. And then you personally have to be ready to talk the second half of the whole equation, which is divided into parts, okay? When you're in an interview, they want to clarify your technical capabilities. From your resume, they're going to ask you the rest of the story. As was it Paul Harvey, right? They're going to read the sentence off your resume that is the cliffhanger story, and then they're going to say, finish the story. Tell us what this means right here. And you need to be ready. They're going to want to know how you owned a task from soup to nuts, from start to finish. They want you to own the task, right? You got to communicate that to them clearly, quickly, and without trying to impress them, right? You just want to say, oh, well, you know, it was really interesting. I did this, this, and this, you know. I'll give you an example from my own life in that realm. I got very fortunate. Again, I started in the software business at 18. So by the time I got to EA to do any type of interviewing process, you know, they were like, well, what products have you worked on? And I was able to say, well, you know, I helped create this product called TurboTax that everybody knew. And then I said, look, and I got laid off from TurboTax at one point and went off and created tons of video game artwork. And I actually came out with a game called Mutant Warriors, which was bought by Virgin Mastertronics, and called Ray Trace. Just did that in a kitchen and a garage. I said we lived off credit cards and ate Stouffer's dinners for a year. And we got this product sold, made all of our money back. Now, see, I was young when I got to EA, and so they didn't expect me to have a gigantic repertoire, right? But I already had more than most kids. And so when it came to saying, well, this kid can handle it, he did it by himself with one other guy, you know, to did all the coding. And I had another side friend that I got in the video game business, who's now huge in the business. He's just my friend who lived down the street. He did some of the mathematics of, you know, the hit tables and that kind of stuff, right? When they heard that, they were like, okay, this kid has already taken products to market, both this analytical tax product, and there was a lot of things that I invented in that, and so I had the kind of proactive design mind of how to make that thing better. And then these video games, which just literally had a clean slate, and we built it up from scratch. And our game, by the way, I think was cannibalized heavily in the industry. I think Fallout ended up using a lot of the mechanisms that our game had. The way that you roam the world and pick up things and listen to recordings and that kind of stuff. We had that stuff. We didn't have it in audio form because it was too early in the industry, but a lot of the way our game worked had those elements in it. So when I play Fallout, it's sort of like this kind of feeling that somebody, you know, moved up who had seen the product and done it. So it's really kind of cool. The old product, not the new one. But in the interview, they want to know your technical capabilities. But then there's a whole other side that people don't realize is going on. And this is what I actually relegated myself to Electronic Arts, because we had, you know, 3 or 4 interviews a day. And I'm the director, you know, one level above the manager. I replaced myself with 3 managers because the department got so massive. We had, you know, EA Sports, EA Games, and EA.com. So I had 3 different managers on all 3 of those. And so I had to manage that whole thing from a director level position because my boss, again, resigned in protest, and then I got his job. It's kind of cool. Just kept Battlefield promotions all the way up. What I would do in these interviews is I told my employees who were conducting interviews as part of the process, the managers, I said, look, you need to really make sure that these guys are technically qualified. Make sure you have what you need. I'm going to come in second, and I'm going to make them feel like they have the job. I'm going to interview them in a passive tense voice about after they start, when they start, you know, just give them that positive feeling that I've already decided they're going to be hired without telling them they're going to be hired. And I want to see if they chill out. Do they calm down and become a normal human being, or are they a big bag of nerves? Because Electronic Arts was not a place where you get employed to be a big bag of nerves. If you showed up in a suit, we'd send you back home because you don't understand the culture that you're about to get into, right? I put a footnote in that. When I was an employer, huge team, whole side of the whole second half of a giant skyscraper we had was our department. And I never chased schedules. I said, look, between 11 and 2, I want you here at work because usually we need to bump into you once a day. I said, if you got a meeting with the client, which is some other person inside Electronic Arts, you got to be there on time. Otherwise, you run your own world, and the only thing I care about is you getting your job done at the scheduled time that you said you'd have it done. If you need to work at home, you just work at home. But if you miss that deadline, all your privileges go away, and if you miss a second deadline, you might end up getting terminated. Nobody got terminated due to missing a deadline. We actually had a guy that would come to work and sleep at his desk. One of the most amazing artists, programmers in Flash I'd ever seen. He created these amazing, beautiful websites. But he was moonlighting starting his own company at home, so he'd come to our place. Never missed a deadline. But he'd come and fall asleep at the desk. And the employees finally just said, look, we can't have this anymore. He's literally snoring at his desk. And we told him to stay home. Stay home and sleep, man. You're not missing your deadlines. Don't worry about it. If you're moonlighting, that's cool. You need more cash or you just want to start your own thing. But he kept coming to work and falling asleep. So finally I had to ask him to leave. It was weird. And I loved the guy. It was crazy. And he went off and became extremely successful with his business. And he's been extremely successful ever since. So it was cool. It was just sort of an understanding between us, right? So there's a social element to getting a job. When you walk into the venue that you're trying to get your job at, you need to pay attention to who's sitting where. Take in the impression of the location. Do you like the cubicles? Do you like how far you're going to be from the sun internally? Do you like the fluorescent lighting that's above? You need to make sure that the environment is something you're willing to live with, because there are options out there in most cases, right? You may need to move if you're in the Midwest and you only got a couple jobs. There's no reason to be a slave in the world for any reason at all. Being a slave is being a slave. So, you know, I don't really work in places that have crappy lighting and just crappy people and stuff. So I've been very fortunate to work in very family-oriented places, right? Now, when it comes to being qualified, there's 2 sides to that. So of our 2 hemispheres, there's being qualified for the job, and then there's chillaxing with the guy such that you can really blend in with the culture of the place. But what I always tell folks, and people get worried about this, and once I tell them how to frame it in their mind, they typically don't get don't get so worried about it, which is the following. You're going to have a technical need to be able to do something for that company, right? If you're a programmer, you're going to learn how to program. If you're a manager, you need to learn how to manage. You need to be able to do it before they hire you, of course. Once you get the job, or even during the interview process, what you need to understand is there's a family way at that company. It doesn't matter how tiny it is. It could be Google. It could be a little tiny startup down the street. But they have a family way. And obviously, the smaller the company, there's less rules on this process. But you need to probably say in the interview, depending on how smooth it's going, right? Make sure that they understand, that you understand, that there's a family way that you're going to have to learn, and you're excited about it because, you know, obviously if they're interviewing you, then they have success in their back pocket, right? And you should be excited about riding that wave with them, but you're going to need to put some effort into it, right? Now, since we're on the point, let's say you get the job. Let's go to the next stage in there. We're going to loop back to resumes and that kind of stuff. And then I'll talk about helping you raise your salary cap. Once you get a job, to the degree it is something that's not hand spoon-fed to you, I should say. Like if you have an uncle that just gives you a job, well, you can probably just sleuth in there and not be your best or what have you, not really try that hard. But that's not very common. Once you get a job that you dig, here's what you got to do. For at least, this is just my rule of thumb, for at least 90 days at that job, you want to arrange your personal life such that you get to spend extra hours at work. Unless you're in a government institution where they say 5 o'clock, you get the hell out of Dodge. Still, anything you can do to sort of blow minds for the first 90 days, do it. Now, again, the more institutionalized the job is, you might actually have people that tell you to stop doing that, right? I've had two friends that had jobs completely different from each other. One went to go work for the NSA, and one was a welder, or no, a machinist. Both of them told me the same story. They worked extra hard at night, stayed extra hours, just loved their job. They just loved their job. And their employees grabbed them, pulled them aside and said, stop doing that. We're a 9-to-5 organization, and if you work one extra hour, you're making us all look bad. Isn't that interesting, right? My buddy was a machinist. He actually worked the same amount of hours, but what he did was skip lunch because he liked to go home an hour early. So he's working the same amount of hours. But his other buddies, or associates, who worked there a little bit longer than he did, would take their lunch, and they'd think he was just trying to show off. But they didn't quite understand that he just wanted to leave early. So you need to be aware of that algorithm, too, as I give you this advice to kick ass for 90 days. But I say that every time I've ever worked anywhere, I tell my family, I tell my friends that for 90 days, I'm going to be hunkering down to blow these people away, to make an impression. And what I typically do is use the first 2 weeks to figure out what I can do to blow people away. What are the things that I can own that straighten this company out? And all I ever do, and this is the key to the game, is I put myself empathetically and vicariously in the seat of the CEO of the company. I listen to CEOs talk, and I always end up working for them in the end, right? I went to Electronic Arts. Nobody knew who I was. By the time I got to the dot-com industry, in the dot-com division, I should say, I took my relationship with Steve Jobs, which I had through email, and I emailed him about Electronic Arts switching back to Macintosh computers, and he offered me 100 CPUs within the hour. And so that started a negotiation between Apple and EA. So I was the reason why those two companies got together and never shared anything, right? So then I went to John Rigatello with that relationship, who was the CEO and general manager of Electronic Arts at the time when Larry Probst actually moved out. And actually, John actually moved over to the dot-com division and ran that, but then he eventually moved back up to run the company. But I had to bring the whole thing to him, and I said, look, I got Steve Jobs on the hook, sending his staff of people here, and I've been negotiating with them for a couple weeks now, and these negotiations took 2 years. right? But that allowed him to know that I am thinking like a VP, even though I was just a director. And all the VP positions were actually locked up, so I couldn't actually get promoted before they actually had financial troubles due to the dot-com bust thing. But I can't tell you the number of times that I've worked for a company, and I am operating as if I am a duplicate of the CEO. And I'm not trying to tell people what to do at all. What I'm trying to do is to say if the CEO spirit lifted out of his body and went into mine and was sitting in my position, what would the CEO do with what I'm doing? What would be the excellence? What would be the level of command and proactiveness that the CEO would do if they had my job? And once I approach it like that, I'm invincible. I had a startup I worked for in the Bay Area in Campbell, California. My first week, I went into an interview, or sorry, I went into a meeting, and, you know, I just got the job. And they had a VP-level person, one of the co-founders, talking about what we should do for an interface for our product. And it was a super bad idea. It was very complex and convoluted, and I was an interface designer and had been for years. I mean, I had taught classes for years at a previous company on how to design interfaces. And I protested in the meeting a little bit and said, you know, I just don't think this is, you know, we can get this down, we can get the click count down, we can get the component level down, you know, the number of things on the screen down and accomplish the same exact goal. And this guy was just into being right, you know. His charter was to pump himself up and not pump up the company and not keep it clear. So he pulls out a trump card. And you'll have this happen in your life where he said, well, you know, I talked to Peter, the CEO, and he said he wants it like this. Now, just knowing my shit and just applying some common sense, I know that Peter had nothing to do, the CEO, with this decision, nor would he even be presented with such a dilemma to solve. That's why he has employees, right? So I said that I didn't believe that that was the case. I can't imagine that Peter would be involved with this. I think you're just using his name to get your way. And there's a whole fucking room full of 15 people. And I'm 26, 27 years old. And again, I've already been through the machine in this world, you know. I'd released multi-million dollar products for almost a decade at that point, right? And so the guy got pissed, came out of the meeting, and very graciously, again, I'm a brand new employee, right? And he says, you know, it's all about moving the ball forward. You know, it's more important that we move the ball forward than, and we agree as a team than for any one of us to pull out and, you know, be an individual. And I said, you're missing the point completely. I said, I'm out for this company's success. It's not about my ego. You made it about your ego, and you use Peter as a trump card to try and force your way through his vicarious approval. And the guy was sort of an infantile PhD mind, right? You know, when you spend too much time in college, you have no social grace, right? You're the most socially inept, you know, antisocial, psychotic person when you get done with a PhD, unless you're a very astute person like maybe Richard Feynman that slept with most of his students' wives during his tutelage. So they arranged for me to meet Peter the next day for lunch across the street. And so I felt great. I felt awesome. I didn't feel nervous at all. They're trying to, you know, straighten my shit out. And I'm like, fuck you. I will leave if this is the way this place runs, right? So I went across the street. And again, I carry myself like a man. Like I do right here. I don't, you know, I don't bullshit anybody. I don't burden anybody. I don't lie to anybody. So I don't need to cower down and protect all my misdirections with people, right? So I went over and I remember this giant leather booth and the Peter's in that booth. Sweet guy. Awesome guy. To this day, he's a great guy. And I squeeze in there. And, you know, I'm a young kid. I managed to get rid of my pimples by this time. But, you know, I came on in this company as an expert programmer and an expert artist. And I sat there and he said, well, you know, I was told we had a little bit of a problem yesterday. And I said, yeah, I said, we did have a problem. I said, so-and-so was using your name to get his way. And it was a blatantly obvious over-design of an interface, and this is going to be the homepage of our website. So we're putting confusion straight on the website, and he's hired a professional that this guy had a PhD in programming, right? He had no knowledge of interface design whatsoever, right? And all the other ones were just hacks that just kind of picked up things along the way, read a little manual and thought they were experts, right? I said, look, he was using your name, and he said that you had reviewed this interface and personally approved it and said, this is the way that you want it to be. And I don't believe that. And I said, we can't have deception at the VP level and run this company efficiently. And Peter laughed. He laughed. That laugh that means you and I are going to be really good friends the rest of our lives, right? And at that point, he's like, you're right. I had never seen that interface because I wasn't aware of how it went down. And for obvious reasons, he didn't divulge that to me when he decided I should meet with you because you might be having issues already in your first week. He goes, I like your style. Keep it up. I'll have a talk with so-and-so to calm him down and make him realize that he did hire an expert and he can trust your opinion. Boom. Peter and I were then best friends. So I walk in the company of 45 people, and the CEO and I are on the same wavelength. And we just wink, wink, nudge, nudge. It wasn't like I need to showboat in front of anybody that had this relationship with the CEO. But every single company I've ever worked for before that, I had the exact same relationship with the CEO. And again, when you take your life seriously, people can take you seriously. And CEOs do not fuck around. You need to understand, if they lose their company, they lose a tremendous amount of usually their personal capital that they've invested in the company. They lose their livelihood. They slip in their mind. They didn't succeed. And so when we're all in it to win it, and the bullshit's not allowed in the group, then you're in a good position. Now, if Peter had said to me, well, you know, it's more important that we design by committee and all this other stuff, which he did not say, but if he had said that to me, I would have looked for another job in 2 seconds. No way would I stick around for a big bunch of self-indulgent bullshitters, right? But that's not the way the company ran. So I want to give you that story in case you run into something like that. Your integrity is paramount. Being honest is paramount. Burdening other people within your organization when you should be doing the hard work, that's a big no-no. And believe me, there's people that will never listen to this video who do that all the time. They'll come to work late, not do their job, let everything stack up, and then you will run over there and try to save the company by doing their job. And I want to tell you, if you're ever a manager, or even employee, I'll just give you my advice. The one thing you don't want to say is, it's not my job. Now, you don't have to say that, because no one wants to hear that job. Hear anyone say that at a managerial level, because they're like, be a team player. But I've always told my employees, when I had 55 and then a whole bunch of consultants, I said, look, I don't want any one of you to do each other's job unless there's a favor asked between the two of you and you agree to take on the favor. Because if someone's not doing their job, I need to know and I need to fire them. And I never had a problem of people not doing their jobs. Because they knew the second they didn't do their job that no one was going to do it. Because I said this at department meetings, right? My department's meetings were in these amphitheaters that we had Electronic Arts because it was too huge to put it in one room, right? And I tell them that. And everyone knew. You know, it's almost like an armed society. You want to pull out a gun at the convenience store? Well, everyone around you's got a gun too. So it's just, let's hope you're a faster draw, because they're going to have one in your back, one in your face, one in your side. You're not going to get away with being a stick-up kid. Same thing at a company. Whoever's failing, just let them fail. You know, now to the degree, I've had actually close friends of mine recently have a situation where it was at a medical clinic, and the person not doing their job was actually not fulfilling prescriptions for people who had psychiatric issues. And so that person was like, well, I need to highlight the fact they're not doing their job, but these people need medical assistance. So I'm going to go ahead and help them out getting their medical assistance, because we actually could have malpractice suits and people getting hurt. And this person's a wonderful person, would never want anybody to be hurt. So you do have situations where maybe you need to ebb in and help out. Or, you know, your whole company is going to fail if this person doesn't do their job, right? Anyway, you feel me. So let's talk about building that resume real quick. We're going to jump around a little bit here just to kind of keep things interesting. So you've heard of the one-page resume objective. And a lot of people angst over this because there's this weird, you know, oracle of knowledge which never has an identity that's telling us to do one-page resumes. And everyone's always like, well, that doesn't work for my job. Here's how I recommend you do it. Just being an employer, and I've said this once before on an episode somewhere, for every 10 years you've been in your job, you get one page. Unless literally you've been in the same position for your whole life and then you've lucked out. I mean, literally, there's nothing wrong. There's nothing wrong with having a job your whole life. Nothing wrong at all. You have a great one page, an amazing one page. But if you've bounced around about every 4 years, you get one page for every 10 years of your life. Okay? Now, there's a lot of philosophies on how to build resumes, but I can tell you as an employer, I mentioned in a previous episode something called the executive summary. This is a big deal when you start at a company and you start engaging higher and higher level individuals, the VPs, the senior VPs, and the CEOs. They never have any time to read shit. So when you communicate with one of these individuals, you need to communicate in 5 bullets. This fly running around here. 5 bullets. And if you got to go to 6, it better be a damn good 6. Sometimes what I do when I'm communicating with folks is I write 5. And then I sort of write a header, and I say optional information, you know, additional information, and then I write my other bullets. And that way they can stop reading if they need it. They kind of assess it. You don't get to become a CEO if you're some anal retentive, read the book from start to finish. Those people never become CEOs because they're too anal retentive and they're too regimented and not dynamic enough to deal with the chaotic reality of actual life, right? So there's 2 words I want to put in your mind, and these were, I read this in 1988 in Psychology Magazine, and I've never heard it repeated, and I don't know why, because it's perfect bucket system for how we think as human beings. There's stringers and there's groupers. Stringers read a book from cover to cover, and they feel guilty if they skip a page. A grouper never reads the book cover to cover. They read it like a reference manual. They get in and get out what they need. And then they do their job and they move on, right? You will have individuals. This fly thinks my hair smells great. You have individuals who are both. They're right down the center. But if you take a spectrum of stringer and grouper, you're somewhere in there. You're either chronic grouper, chronic stringer, or you're somewhere in the middle. Now, I'm probably a middle towards grouper. I've had to learn how to be a stringer. I will never be a chronic stringer. I just can't do it. Life is not like that, right? But some people try to regiment their life, super duper left brain people, and they try to live on the other side. And they're always frustrated because life doesn't line itself up beautifully. It's always chaotic. So the people who run the world are groupers more so than stringers. You might have someone at the top that assists a grouper and is a chronic stringer, and they balance each other out. But the dude or dudess at the top is usually a grouper. Because most people who are hiring are groupers, and again, you will have your stringer interview person, you'll be able to use this term in your own mind to decide how to communicate with them, because it's very important. The way I've written my resume several different ways, and I've always gotten the job, so I've had success with all different formats, but I think it's because when I go in the interview, I can usually win them over during the interview process, the talking process, right? Part of it's being articulate. Do not use broken English. I've got friends of mine who've had really hard times finding jobs for years, but when they talk to me on the phone, they're talking in kind of slangy, broken English. And it's not that they don't know how to speak correctly. They just think it's funny to go back and be lazy when they talk. Really bad idea, right? Any habit you build in the world is a habit that you have. And so why build a habit doing things that you don't want to do? And here I am using F-bombs from time to time in the show. Not a good idea. Sometimes you'll be interviewing someone and they drop an F-bomb, and maybe they're testing to see if you're a big cusser. You can make a big decision at that point whether or not you're going to fall into that and show them, yeah, I cuss too, right? And they might be concerned. If you're a customer-facing job, they might be freaked out you're going to be dropping F-bombs and think that, you know, talking like you did when you're in high school is the way to roll. But here's the way I build my resume. Very specifically, I put the name of the company, put an underline, I put the number of years, month and year that I was actually at that organization. The month I started, the month they exited, and the years off to the side. Underneath that, I give a job title in bold, and underneath that, I try to keep it to 5 bullet items as to what the hell I did in that position. Now, again, if you work 10 years at a company, five is probably not going to do it unless you had a very, very focused, optimized job, right? So you can go ahead and give yourself some more bullets. Just know that after five, you're starting to tire and fatigue the mind of the person reading it. Okay? I also divide up past and present. So for the present job, you know, if you had an 8 by 8.5 wide piece of paper, I bring a board all the way to the edge and I say present, tab in to a invisible column here. I'm just going to give you the details of how I do it, name of the company, and then that year spread. Then tabbed in, I give my five bullets. Then the next line down is a complete underline again, duplicate at the top, and instead of saying present, it says past. And it's the very next company I worked for before I had the one I have. If you have multiple present companies, you have your own company and you work for other people, or you have four or five companies like me, I just line them up underneath of that first present section. Then I go to past and line them all up down below. After that, if you're in a technical field of any kind, when I say technical, I mean there's some type of certification attached to what you do. So you could be a nurse, you could be a programmer, you could be an engineer. If there's certain skill sets they want to know that aren't evident by your job history, right? They want you to call it out in a table down below. So again, you repeat that whole past thing. It's all indented a little bit. Again, just name of the position, you know, company, year spread, name of position, the bullets go all the way down. When you finish up, again, you may need to, if you have a one-page resume, you may want to save yourself a little bit of a couple inches at the bottom to do this, but it's okay if you spill over into some addendum on the next page, but you might say skills. And you want to build a table of all your skills. In programming, we usually talk about all the languages that we know. Then we talk about all the platforms that we've programmed on. In video games, it's what consoles you've programmed on or what consoles you've released products on. They usually want to know if you're fluent, familiar, or novice. So you might rate all your languages. You might put C++, tab over, fluent, Java, familiar, you know, Python, beginner, something like that. Let them know where you are in the spectrum of skill sets. The more honest you are and efficient you are in your resume, the better off you are. Okay? Then you have something that comes at you every once in a while, which is sort of a novice employer problem, which is they want you to give your objective. I find that the organizations that want an objective statement at the beginning of your resume are usually fairly juvenile organizations. It's been written by someone who went through college. They've got a process for a very dynamic thing, and they ask you what your objective is. Now, there's a couple reasons why I think objectives are complete bullshit. One, without actually knowing everything about the company you're talking to, your objective statement is just a random shot in the dark that can do more harm to you than good. I don't do them. I don't give a shit what they say. I don't do them. If I'm doing it, it's going to be almost a letter to my employer. Dear employer, this is who I am. This is what I live for. This is what I'm looking to get out of your company. I do not say, I want to be the best person. Because if anyone has half of a clue of how the world works, they know that you're going to cut and paste. You're going to use words like empower and other bullshit phrases just to lure them into interviewing you. And it seems trite. It seems disingenuous. And anybody who's relying on that statement to bring you in has no fucking clue how the world works. All right. And so to the degree that someone stresses an opening statement to you, it's to the degree that they don't understand what they're talking about. And you're going to find this in more institutionalized organizations. If you work for colleges, they've been in academia their whole life. They haven't actually had a job in the real world. So they're relying on classes that they took to try to pretend to be professionals. Right. Just being real. The objective statement comes out during the interview process. Forming a sentence that's all, you know, pre-designed to look good is easy to do. You can cut and paste someone else's thing, like I said. But coming in and I look you right in the face and I go, why do you want to work here? Why are you leaving that place that you're at? That will put you on the spot. And if you can't articulate a clear vision as to why we're having this conversation and why I should even think about interviewing you, then you're not for me. You just showed me you don't have it. So if you were to rely on that opening statement as an employer, you're robbing yourself of a very organic need to really get into who your person is. And I'll tell you one reason why this is the case. I had two utterly, phenomenally bad interviews at Electronic Arts where I interviewed people. Both were foreigners. One was a gentleman from India, and one was a gentleman with decidedly a heavy Russian accent. And I could only hope that it was a cultural misunderstanding between how we employ people in America and how they get employed where they come from. And I wish, I really tried with the Russian guy, because he spoke enough English I could completely communicate with him. But I sat in an interview with this guy from India, who unfortunately looked like he didn't have enough money to really dress properly. I mean, I was trying, but he didn't speak English. And when I say he didn't speak English, he knew you're hired. He knew that phrase, right? And Princess wasn't on television yet. I am asking him questions about his resume, which looks amazing. Somebody who spoke English prepared this resume. I started to do what I do, which is I come in the room and I started speaking past tense as to whether or not, you know, like he's hired and this is what kind of job he would do and this is where I'll put him in the company. But he didn't understand a word I'm saying. And so I said, this is freaking weird. How did I get in a room with the guy that didn't speak English? I'm a director. This guy should have been vetted by one of my underlings first before I walk in the room. So I started asking him basic questions in life. Just, you know, where do you live? You know, I can't even remember, but it was just basic questions. And this guy just kept looking at me and saying, do I have the job? And really bad English. I have job. I stood up to leave, and because I'm telling him I got to go, and he doesn't understand a word I'm saying. I don't know how this guy got into the building and put in that seat by anybody. Because to say, come with me, sit down here, we'll be here to talk to you, he wouldn't know what anyone's saying. And I just happened to walk out the room, bump into my HR rep, and I said, look, why the hell is this guy in here, right? Can't help that guy. Bad news, right? But someone wrote his resume for him. And that is why if someone's going off the resume, you're completely duping yourself, which is why the interview process is usually really handy, which is why interviewing them through telephone first is usually a good idea because you don't confuse them by bringing them in and setting up their expectations otherwise. Electronic Arts at the time was very difficult to get into, and it got loosened up because we needed to grow by thousands of people very quickly. And so we actually did extremely well and brought in a lot of great people. I'm unaware of more than maybe a half a dozen people that didn't work out. But the next guy I interviewed was this Russian guy. And he looked really tired. And he was sweating like crazy. He was a little bit overweight. It's almost like he was just peeking himself out. And I had his resume. And he can fully speak perfect English, right? Nice guy. And so I started interviewing about the process of what, you know, I started doing the past tense thing, but then I started realizing, okay, his resume didn't really have the genetics that I needed to have to consider the job. Didn't have the languages that we use to do what we do. So it was going to be a complete train up from the bottom to the top. We don't have time for that. We need experts to come in the door. We'll mentor you after you get in, but it's like, you got to know at least JavaScript for Christ's sake, right? He admitted very quickly he didn't know how to do anything that we needed him to do. And he said, if I give him the job, he'll learn it. And I said, well, I can't do that because we have qualified people walking in left and right, but I'll tell you what I will do. I said, I will walk in the other room and I will get the books that you need to read. I'll just take them out of one of my employees' cubes and I'll take them out of my office. I'll give them to you. You take them home and you call me when you think you've understood what are in those books. Then we'll just re-interview you and I'll give you the job. To his credit, but to his discredit, he was honest with me and he said, I have a kid on the way. I work a job all the time to pay for my family and my kid, who's on the way, and his wife worked at home. She didn't work at home. She stayed at home. And he goes, I know I don't have the time to read your book. And I was like, wow. Socialistic, communistic Russia burned this guy's brain out to not understand what you need to do in life. If he thinks he doesn't have time now, wait till his child is born. And his wife is emaciated at night from handling this kid for 10 hours, 12 hours straight. And she starts, or he starts crying in the middle of the night at 2 a.m. And you got to figure out what you got to do. This guy had no idea the Mack truck that was headed towards his head. And his only hope was to put a little more effort into his knowledge base, take free books home. Even if he didn't come back to me, I would have preferred him to take the books from me with a grin and go learn. I was sitting in front of him because that's exactly what I did with my life, with nobody paying for the books and no one giving a shit whether or not I live or die, which is how most of us live, right? No matter who's blowing smoke up your ass, people care about you, but they don't really care about you. It's weird. It's just a fact of life, right? If you find someone who genuinely cares about you, really gets deeply into your success models of life and supports you as intellectually as they possibly can, you got the right person in your life. All right. It's very critical when it comes to being successful in your career. So to recap, before we go back into some salary tricks and some other stuff, your job is to build a resume to entice them to interview you. Your entire tense in life is to put yourself in the seat of the person who's in charge and live through their eyes at your job. They're trying to duplicate themselves. The number one qualities that will get you a job is not only knowing, technically speaking, what to do, but you need to be a self-starter, and you need to come at it from their perspective. You know, one of the things that'll happen with early employees is that they say, well, I got stuck. And, you know, as an employer, you go, well, what did you do then? They say, well, I didn't know what to do, so I just sat here and looked at my computer. That's grounds for letting somebody go, at least on the second time. I don't give people three strikes with that sort of shit. I say, look, the second you get stuck, you get off your ass and you find somebody to help you, or you do it yourself. Especially with the internet, there's no excuse not to find it online, right? But if you're one of these people that gets stuck and you just sit on your hands, brace yourself for being fired. But if you want to be an excellent employee in your employer's eyes, you get off your lazy ass and you go get the solution somehow. Be a self-starter, because that CEO in the middle of the night at 2 a.m. has no one helping them succeed. You're not living through their eyes, you're not living as they live, and you're not being the duplicate of them that they need. Again, you know, this may not be for your current position. You may not like your current position enough to be a self-starter, but honestly, try not to just get jaded at your employer and create a bunch of bad habits despite them. You know, and sometimes, again, there's people around you that don't do their job, so you can be a self-starter all you want, and it's not going to help anything, because there's always someone not doing their job. So there's definite, you know, exceptions to the rule, but you don't want to let those exceptions be a part of your being, right? Now, let's talk about salary. Sorry, my cigar keeps needing corrections here. When you smoke in a windy day, the wind tends to make one side of the cigar burn and the other side doesn't. So you have to correct it by lighting the other side that's not burning. Salary. One of the biggest dilemmas that people have is how much money should they ask for? And they get all nervous. No reason to be nervous, all right? I'm going to tell you a process that I use to figure out how much to get paid, and then this is going to dovetail directly into asking for more money at your current company. But there's a caveat to this, okay? What we're going to construct is a feeling of confidence inside your soul, because without that feeling of confidence, you're never going to get what you need. There's two factors to the equation. One is non-negotiable, and one is negotiable. The non-negotiable factor of your salary is what you need to live, to exist. And the other side is the increase that you get for every 10 years to 5 years you've been in that particular profession. I say five because some of the jobs bust your balls really, really fast and you get to be really, really good in 5 years. The way I approached my life was to move up so fast through the ranks and to work so hard that within a couple of years I was able to ask for more money, right? You'll know whether or not you think you have achieved a higher level. And usually it's you're outperforming your peers that are making more money than you. You can't quite use that as a rationale. But again, if your work at a company is responsible for bringing in revenue to the company, you have an argument to take to the company and say, look, I'm producing a lot of cash for this company personally, and therefore I want a bigger slice for my skill set. We'll get into the details of that in a second. So let's go to the first one. How much money you need to exist, right? I realize I say right a lot. I apologize. You might think, well, that's real easy. I just take all my bills and I create a worksheet at home and I find out how much money my rent, all my food expenses, and my utilities, car payments, all that stuff, kid payments, whatever. You're almost right. The other one you need to add into that as an imperative to your existence is your luxury money. And don't get crazy. If you want to get crazy with your luxury money, earn it on this other column over here, which is your skill set that has earned the extra pay. That's how you get crazy with your luxury money. But you do need money to stay sane. Your definition of sane and your mechanisms of sane are going to be completely different than your neighbors, than mine, etc. It shouldn't be bigger than your expense side, right? It should probably be at least a fourth to a third of your expense, depending on, you know, how much you save money on your expenses. If you're willing to cook your own meals and, you know, you do things to save money at home, then you can put more into your well of fun when you go ask for your position. But now, once you've created this base salary, this base number that you need over here, you need to feel utterly confident in that number. That is what you deserve as a human being on planet Earth based on your cost of living of where you live, right? It has to be related to California if you live in California, Kansas if you live in Kansas. When I got into the video game business, we had a guy who lived in Wisconsin that was flying to Oxnard, California to draw video games. He got paid at least a third less than me. But he had been in business longer than me because his cost of living in Wisconsin was less. And they simply adjusted his salary down based on the cost of living. And he was fine with that because he was a professional and an adult. Okay. Now let's go into the side that is your you're really good at what you do and need to figure out what you're paid. Now, part of that goes hand in hand. If you're a professional that knows what you're doing, you should also know what people pay for what you do. Part of what you can do is go off to look online and find out what independent agencies are charging for the same headcount that you provide. Now, it can get confusing, and I can tell you a personal story of mine, which kicks off into you increasing your salary, but I've always made a decent salary, like a really good salary, right? At a very young age, I made a man's salary because I was holding down at least as much work as they did and probably a little bit more because of my tenaciousness, right? And I produce cash for the companies that use my skill set. I always do. When I was working at 23, and I'd managed to get a consulting job that paid me by the hour. And I'll just tell you, I was making about 22 something an hour, 22.50 an hour, which for a 23-year-old kid was okay. Okay. But then this independent agency came to me and said, we want to hire you to work for us and not this other consulting agency you're working for. And they said, we'll start you off at $45 an hour. What? I was making 22 and this people coming up just saying 45, and this is before negotiations, right? I could have said 50, right? And I probably would have got it. And they said, that guy over there is making 45, and his brother over there is making 40, who was 18 years old. Now, because I was young, I had no age discrimination, but I was like, I know that kid's skill set. It's good, but it ain't even half of what I got, right? So I got really pissed off that I was getting fucked by this company that I was working for. Now, again, if you read Robert Kiyosaki's Rich Dad, Poor Dad, what you'll learn in that book is that you get paid whatever you think you should be paid, and that's the trick. But I didn't read that book until 10 years later. Okay. I call up my boss, and I say, look, I'm getting offered $45 an hour. Well, this is $22 an hour bullshit. I came to find out I was being billed at $90 an hour. That's how much money I was bringing in for this company. he called me back. He said, well, let me call my account. We'll figure out what we can do. And he goes, you know, I pay for benefits, and you know, I pay for you when you don't have a job, which he was actually lying out of his ass, because as soon as we finished the contract, he was trying to reduce my salary and trying to move me around, a bunch of weird shit. But only believe what you got on paper. That's all I got to say, right? Someone makes a claim to you as it doesn't matter how old you are. If you don't have it in writing with the signature at the bottom, it's just bullshit. It's, I don't give a fuck if you date this guy's daughter, go out on the lake with him, he pays for your sushi dinner at night. If you don't have it in writing, it doesn't exist, okay? So just take that one to the bank. But what happened was a paradigm shift in my mind, a paradigm shift in my voice. I tiptoed towards 22 something an hour. I can't even remember what the cents were, but it was like 2050 or some bullshit, right? I tiptoed towards that because I'd never made that kind of money before at the time. But when I heard I was getting screwed, my tone was like, this shit's going to change right now. And when I went and asked that guy with absolutely, I am out of here if you don't fucking increase my salary right away, within 24 hours, my salary doubled, more than doubled, all right? Because I went in confident. Now imagine that, I'm 23 years old, and my salary doubles in 24 hours. I didn't go with this new company. I kind of regret not going to the new company because of the charade that this guy pulled after we finished the contract, and I finished it beautifully, and you know, everybody was extremely happy. But now I understand his shoes because I eventually became a CEO of my own. And I realized, okay, I should have gotten writing. But anyway, I was fine. I put away enough money. I was fine. But that's the trick of making more money when you have a salary. And this is why you won't believe me until you try it. If you live in an area where there's not a lot of jobs, Flint, Michigan, right? This won't work, most likely. But if you live in an area with plenty of jobs, and if your company's doing well and they're not hemorrhaging cash and they're not laying off people, you can do what I'm about to tell you. And again, you may just need to move to a new position if it's sour where you are. But the number of folks that I've told this story to, and it goes just like this. I said, you need to go home and do a spreadsheet. Get your expenses, get your well of happiness on top of your expenses, which is again a quarter to a third of that first expense column, depending on how much you sacrifice in your expense column, right? And then for every 5 to 10 years, you've actually had this job and you kill it. And you got to be honest with yourself whether or not you kill it or not, right? You can increase the salary. And when you walk in there, your heart and your soul sounds different. Just again, it's like the Hindus say, when you form a phrase, like I sound a certain way to you, hopefully I don't sound like I'm full of shit. Right? But the reason why I don't sound like I'm full of shit, one is Mike is fantastic picking up my voice. You get my tone from my being perfectly preserved. It's a very analog, beautiful, rich, creamy microphone, right? But the other reason is that when I form an opinion or form a statement in myself, I know that I do not allow bullshit to enter my soul to then create statements of bullshit to you. I create the most genuine, whether or not I'm right or wrong, I create the most genuine form of communication I can, and that is a scent on an audio level that comes through this microphone down to your device into your head. And that's what the Hindus believe, is that a person who lies can be felt lying. Now again, some scam artists get really good at it and they screw up the entire world because they'll start making good people feel bad because they pretend to have a good voice. Right, an honest voice, and then they screw you. And then every time you hear someone that sounds like that, well, you think that they're telling you a lie. And that's where you get jaded over time. So you got to be careful. Try not to blame new people for old people's mistakes, right? Now, a message to the young listeners. I don't even know if I have any young listeners, so I don't know. But if you're advising a young person, perhaps this will be useful to pass on. We know that there's a lot of kids coming out of college that are full of shit. They have crappy degrees that are nearly unemployable, but for the ones that actually have employable degrees, they're computer scientists, bioengineers, biochem engineers, whatever, really hardcore thinking jobs that only humans can do and robots can't do, right? They get cocky. Now, you might luck out. I've got a friend of mine whose son just graduated from Harvard Law School. The kid is a bona fide genius by all stretches, and he's one of the most humble nature geniuses you've ever met in your life. Because he went through Harvard Law School, the investment banking houses were immediately soliciting him to become a permanent asset of their company to defend them and all this nefarious crap, and he refused to do that. But some of these kids come out, and they don't have the ACE, you know, testing before they went into college, the 4.0 coming out of Harvard School, the bar that they crushed, right? Like my buddy, this kid's 28 years old, just crushed the bar, just didn't get anything wrong. I mean, he's that ingenious, right? But they don't have that accolade, but they believe because of all the entitlement, because mommy and daddy got them a cell phone at 12, got them every game console, every piece of clothing they wanted, the brand new car, that's just the way the life works. And of course, us adults laugh so hard, our guts hurt the next day. Right. If you're one of these kids headed towards your exit in college, or you're about to enter the real world, right? Take a deep breath and realize that working up through the ranks can be one of the best things you can do in your life. I do lectures from time to time at schools for kids that want to get in the video game business. And so they want me to come in and tell them exactly how to go through, get into the video game business and move up. I've contemplated doing that lecture on here, but I just think it's so off topic. It just would be weird. I'm not sure how healthy that industry is right now anyway. But the way you used to do it was you go into technical support and you take phone calls for everyone having a problem with the game. And you start to realize that when a bug gets released in a game, you pay a price. You might get 20,000 phone calls in a week if you release a bugged game. And this is before downloadable patches and that kind of thing. But you never know. Still could be a confusing interface. Something crashes and the coders can't figure out how to fix it. The QA team missed the bug or got lazy. So your next job up in the company is quality assurance, where you actually catch those bugs. And now, because you've been in support, you know how important it is to make sure there's no bugs, right? Then when you become a producer or associate producer and you start working your way up through the design, you know how to put pressure on the QA team to make sure you don't have a bug that goes out that's a crash bug. So it's this incestual, ground-up, systemic understanding of the industry that you're in. And every single company and every single industry has a bottom and a top. To the degree you go past levels is to the degree you put yourself at risk, right? So you have to make sure you don't do that. So be careful with just synthesized confidence that is, I am great, therefore I get this job, with no experience in doing it. And don't be bashful in having confidence. Again, there's nothing wrong with confidence. Arrogance is what we got to be careful about. Arrogance is what kids have, right? They don't have confidence necessarily because why would they? They haven't done anything yet. You will get it. That's the good news. But there's this cocky thing that I always warn kids about. I was always a very humble Midwestern kid when I came out, and my first job interview was at that, after I got done working for Jim Hall Racing. For a very short stint, I did this interview at the TurboTax people, which was called MacTax back in the day, and the guy was showing me the product. And because I knew programming inside and out, I'm looking at this product, and he just literally brought up the program, and he said, what do you think about this? And he scrolled the tax form, and my mind just blew. I was like, holy crap, how much coding does it take to make that happen? And it printed out in a completely different format, ready to sign and send to the IRS. I said, you got, you know, two sets of coordinates in there. How are you doing this? How do you get the font so tiny? It was just phenomenal to me. And once I showed that astonishment and appreciation for the product, that guy knew I was the right employee, because I was showing I understood what the hell I was looking at, and I was amazed. I respected the product. You know, and the next person I met was the CEO. Funny little story. I'll tell you two interview stories and then I'll shut up, because they're kind of funny. I walked around the corner and they said, you got to meet the CEO. So I go into the CEO's tiny little office. I mean, this was a little place in Camarillo, California, off Pleasant Valley Road. And I'm sitting there waiting for the CEO to come in. And the janitor comes in this jumpsuit. He starts emptying the trash and he says, you know, oh, are you here for an interview? And I'm like, yeah. And he says, well, what do you think of this place? And I said, man, this company is so cool. Have you seen the product? It's just phenomenal. I said, I don't know if you code or you know anything about coding. I said, but this, whoever made this is a genius, yada, yada, yada. Guy leaves the room, Guy comes back in without the jumpsuit on, and he is the CEO. He was a big mogul real estate guy here in Los Angeles. I don't even know if he's still alive, but it was a great trick. And he said, "I like you, kid." Didn't hire me on the spot. I went home. I'm floating in the air because I just had this great interview, this great company, and I want this job. And he called me at 8 o'clock that night with the other guy on the phone. I said, "We like you. How does this hourly rate sound to you?" Which was less than I was making at Jim Hall Racing. And I said, "Yes." You know, he said, "You can work as many hours as you want. So don't worry about this being less than what you're getting paid right now." He said, "You can work all day long." And I worked like 12 to 14 hour days for years. I mean, I love this place. I got laid off at one point and got into video game business, right? So let's talk about the video game interview because it was funny as hell. I don't know if you're able to do what I'm about to say, but don't be afraid if you're in the right crowd. So I go in for this interview for this video game company, and I was laid off on a Tuesday. It was April 15th or April 16th, right? The tax season was over, and they brought us all in. They said, "We lost a bunch of money last year, so we're having to let a bunch of you guys go." And I was a cornerstone of this company, right? And because I was younger, they kept a couple new guys a little bit older, and eventually came back and crushed it. But one of these guys gave me a one ad in the paper, and he goes, "Look, man," he goes, "you always draw all of our stuff." And he goes, "I don't know if you've ever drawn video games." I'm like, "Yes. In high school, I had so many games, it was crazy. I draw them, program them and stuff. Multiplayer drag race games, really cool stuff." He said, you might go down and interview. So I called the guy up, arrange an interview. I drive to this beach house in Oxnard, California, and the guys were ingenious. They rented a beach house instead of renting a building. And there was like five guys in there, a couple artists and a bunch of programmers. And this genius guy from IBM who learned how to program IBM CPUs and Intel CPUs figured out how to move bits into a video card super duper fast. So we had this crazy scrolling engine. It was 256 colors, and it could go down to four colors and two colors. And it was tremendous. And it worked on the Amiga platform as well. So we had this absolutely world-renowned engine. But they needed crazy, beautiful artwork in 256 colors, and all had to be hand done, right? There's no 3D rendering at the time. You had to click pixels and make it look photographic, right? So they interviewed me, and they say, "Hey, you know, have you done anything in color?" And I'm like, "Well, you know, I'm a painter, so I know color theory really, really well." But I said, "No, I haven't had a computer that can do color, you know?" He said, "All right. I like what you say." So he said, "Let me send you home with one of my CPUs. You just take it home and draw something and put it on a floppy and bring it to me." So I went home that night, and man, I was drawing all kinds of crazy, you know, aquatic space stations, you know, stations that would be underneath the ocean. I did, rail systems and all kinds of like bullet trains and, you know, corroded barrels that were kind of bent up with the shadows on them and stuff. And I brought back my disc. The guy looked at it and he's like, "You got the job, but I don't have the decision process, right? We got to talk to John, the CEO." Consequently, a company's made out of these legends that are responsible for some of the name brand products out there. Might and Magic. One of the guys went off and created Might and Magic after me. One of the programmers. So I'm sitting in this interview, and I'm downstairs in the living room, which has the balcony that goes out to the beach. And, you know, the beach is just rolling the oceans. It's like right now, it's probably 76, 77 out. It's like perfect, right? But I'm sitting in this beach house, and they just got a big box of Taco Bell tacos, which at the time was not owned by PepsiCo, so the food was actually good and not GMO. They asked me if I wanted one. I said, "Let's finish this interview first before I stuff my face in front of you." So I'm sitting on one edge of the black sofa. He's sitting on the other edge, pretty large sofa, and all the other guys are just standing in the room, and I'm feeling awesome. I knew I kicked the shit out of my test. This guy's just interviewing me, and I can't remember a word he said. But what I do remember is that a big, fat fly was flying around the room in this kidney-shaped format, right? He would fly around John, come at me, go around my head, and everybody was kind of swatting this thing away. But he was like that big, fat fly that's in his last 60 seconds of life, right? He's just digging on life. I was the Grim Reaper, unfortunately. So this thing's coming around constantly in the circle, and so I see the pattern. I'm a video game guy, right? So I see the pattern of the NPC coming around, which is this fly, the non-player character, right? He's on an AI loop, and here he comes. And so I'm sitting there looking at John. Here comes this fly. I snatched the fly out of the sky, out of the air. I looked at him and I said, pardon me for 1 second. I walked up to the wall and I just learned this trick. You can knock a fly out. If you catch a fly, you knock it out on the wall. So I threw it at the wall, hit the ground, and I stomped it. And I sat down and I looked at him. Everyone in the room is watching this, right? And John's like looking around like, what the fuck? You know, and he goes, you're hired. That's it. You get the job. No more questions. I got the job. Pretty cool, right? So don't forget to be human in your interviews. If you're human, and again, don't get crazy, right? You're not in your fraternity. You're not at a party with your buddies. But if you just show a little bit of humanity in your interviews, right? Don't get all tight and uptight. You know, it's not a test at school, man. It's just, hey, if you can't be yourself and make your employer feel comfortable with who you are, then there's no reason to be at that position, right? And that's one thing that people forget, is that you're interviewing them as much as they're interviewing you. And I'll tell you that in the interview process, to the degree you're in a gigantic company, or even a small company, but if you're in a big company, you have a couple of responsibilities on your hand. If they're a publicly traded company, you need to go look up their stock. In all cases, you need to find out what the competition's like in their industry, especially if you're changing industries or you have a generic job like accountant and you need to move in and understand sort of where you are in the industry, right? Do some research before you go into the interview. Simply look up what they do, competition. Put the word competition. If it's injection molding, competition. If it's building trade show booths, competition. You know, or players. Just try to get that product out of the internet, right? Try to look up trade booth. Was it trade show booth construction? If that's what they do, you just look it up like you're hiring that force and try to find the biggest players. If someone's buying ads at the top of Google, then they're probably one of the biggest players. So you need to know where their competition is so that when you go in for the interview, you say, well, how much is, how are you in comparison to these companies, right? Are we a big player in this company? You know, the other thing I do is I use welcoming tenses in my statements as in we, you know. We do. You heard me say it on the show. I'm the only guy doing the deep thoughts, but I'll still say we in the narration of the captions in the video. I'll say join us. It's just me, but it's still a product of Kyle and I. Kyle and I determined what the charter of the show, of the whole MKUltra.com objective is, putting the mind back in mind control, teaching the rules that rule you. It's a we thing. If you can't show them a we thing, then they're going to, you know, once you start talking in we's, they start to feel like, well, he's already part of the family. You know, he really came in and just owned it with us. And so I think he or she is a fit, that sort of thing. So it is a psychological operation to make them feel comfortable with you, you know. When you get to be, and there's a different type of interview, which I'll just throw in the last second here before I shut up. When you run your own company, you're constantly doing interviews of a different kind, which is an interview with the client themselves. And they are doing generally a souped-up version, an exponentially more detailed version of what you're doing to get the job in the first place, right? Which is to convince the company to use your resources to build something for them that they're going to use to make a lot of money, you know. When I started my company, my video game company, that I've since shut down, but we went for 10 years, and again, we made about a little over $6 million bucks. You know, I was the CEO, and because I'm uber technical and all things computers and video games, we were a video game company, I'd walk in there and they would always put me with first the CEO, satisfy him or her, then they put me off to their CTO, which is their chief technical officer, who's going to bust my balls on a technical level. Only a couple times have I had someone request that we use technology that we hadn't used. And so, you know, I was honest in the interview and I said, look, you know, we had a game that needed to communicate in binary with telephones. And in Flash, you didn't usually communicate on a binary protocol, but Flash had just released a binary library to be able to do this. But even the guy who made the programming books, I talked about Mook, Colin Mook, he hadn't documented it yet. You look in the Flash documentation at Adobe, they had no documentation for this. So we had to literally sit and use other commands that were in the manual or in the lookup language and just see what they did and just try to guess how many parameters that they needed, you know. And we figured it out and we became the first company on the planet to communicate in binary and fix their binary transmission problems, which was partial packet transmission problems, right? But you'll have to know your stuff in order to convince people of risk assessment, right? They're trying to see, are you a risk? Do you have holes in your knowledge that's going to put them at jeopardy? Should they use the competition that costs more or costs the same? We usually cost a little bit more. But what we would do is walk in the room, and I'm going to tell you a little trick. I said this in my entrepreneur series, which is an essay. And since we're here, this is part of a game. You can maybe fold this into your personal interview process. But here's what I did as the CEO of my company. You guys are probably tired of hearing about Flash, but this just use this as an analogy for what you do. And you could be a 50-year-old sales executive, and you can still use what I'm doing here. This is something I just stumbled on, and it worked, and I kept using it as a sort of a trade secret. When you're up against competition, sort of your company is auditioning against other companies. Again, you could be a rep at this company, you don't own the place, or you could own the place, and this technique works beautifully. What you need to do is figure out what you do better than your competition. And then you need to walk into this client, tell them about the problem that you've solved, and tell them that if anyone's walking in here competing against us, make sure that before you feed them the problem, that they actually address this problem with you. After the interview, if they don't mention it and see how well they answer the question. And we had a secret thing that we did because when my company made video games in Flash, we built gigantic multiplayer platforms. So like Yahoo Games, we rebuilt Pogo.com, we rebuilt. I mean, we built a bunch of systems at sometimes the back end and the front end, sometimes just the front end. But all we needed was the front end to knock this home run out of the park. Memory issues in Flash were horrible, meaning you use the plugin. It's still the issue, and it's why everyone's getting out of the technology today. But as soon as the Flash plugin runs, it starts sucking memory out. And it used to be horrid. If you didn't program in a very specific way, it didn't do what's called garbage collection and get rid of the memory that's being used as you need more. You're supposed to earmark memory. You can get rid of this if you don't need it. That's why in your mobile devices, every time you start launching apps, sometimes if you have too many launched, you go back to an app that was running and it restarts. And it's because it's had to throw out all of its assets out of memory because someone else needed it as another application. Same thing with Flash, right? We programmed video games on cable boxes first. Time Warner cable boxes, web TV, and that kind of stuff. They have absolutely no memory. And for instance, our games had to be completely playable using only 5% of the processor power. Imagine that. Today, games suck every single piece of processor power out of the CPU, right? But we had to learn how to survive first in 5% memory. And when we had to do that, we realized we needed to explicitly destroy everything as fast as possible that we didn't need. So we developed a best of breed practice learning how to do this on cable boxes. When we moved into full-blown console, or sorry, not console, but full-blown computer multi-network stuff, right? We had no limitations on how much memory we could consume and how much processor power we consumed, but we kept our good habits. So our stuff never consumed memory that then would never come back to the computer. But our competition didn't know about the problem and didn't have the regimen to solve the problem because they believed the documentation that Adobe wrote that they were going to do it for them. So I said, look, our games barely use any memory. We clean up memory constantly. And we, therefore, the processor that we use is 100% for what's on deck on that moment when the game's being played. And I said, go look at your competitors' games, play them for at least 15 minutes, and watch how much memory is disappearing out of your memory cache, and watch how much your processors have renegade processes that are going in loops, animation loops of things that no longer exist on the canvas, no longer exist on the screen. And you'll end up using all your processor power, nothing's happening in the game, and you have no more memory on your machine. And I can tell you right away, when I went to Yahoo and pitched a big deal with them to start rebuilding all their front-end games, they said, you know, it's funny you mentioned that because this poker game we had created in Russia, which I saw the code, it was actually beautifully, beautifully programmed. It's just they were relying on techniques that, again, don't work. And they said, we play this game, two players, we're supposed to be a 10-man poker team multiplayer over the internet, but just two people playing. They said in 10 minutes, all the memory's gone out of the machine, all the processor power is gone because it's in these infinite loops. And the machine locks up until we close this plugin, close the browser. And they go, you're hired. because this is exactly what's killing us with this program. And they actually hired us to redo the other program. But then Yahoo had big changes and we never got around to that particular project. But what I did was the following. I redefined the paradigm of success in the mind of the client with legitimate claims, with legitimate hardships in the trend, in the technology that we were bringing to them. We did this over and over and over for millions of dollars, and we blew away all of our competition, and we were the only company on planet Earth that articulated this to the client. As far as we could tell, we were the only programmers that actually programmed these engines properly, so that wasn't a problem. So if you have a trade, try to find out what you do better than your competition. When you go into the interview, and this could happen on an individual level. Only you know if you could pull this off on an individual interview level, right? But you want to redefine success to match what you bring to the table. And everyone else who walks in after you, either an individual interview or a company-to-company competition interview, you'll win. You'll win. And you'll be imbuing the client with this feeling of superiority that I know, the client will feel, I know what is success. I have magic sauce too because I was given it to by this potential hire. You'll be magic in their eyes. So that is how to get a job. That's how to get the money that you deserve. Remember, it's confidence in the soul, not arrogance, right? You do have to invest in yourself. So don't kid yourself if you don't have the skills that you need. You got to go get them. And it's okay if you need to go get them, right? So work hard. Luck is hard work, right? Luck helps you find opportunity. So you work hard. You get luckier in everything that you communicate, the confidence in your voice, the confidence in the material that you talk to the other person about. And in the end, it will develop the opportunities for you to actually get the job that you need. I want you to be extremely happy in this world, right? We got to rebuild this entire planet. We got to rebuild the politics. We got to rebuild the money. We got to rebuild all the social care of everyone. Everyone needs to work. This can't be some commune of socialistic socialism. And that never works, right? They tried it in the 60s. Everyone made a commune. 3% of the people did all the work and 7% of the people sat on their ass. And there was no global elite agenda on those people. That's just the natural attrition of mankind to be lazy. But there was a time, less than 100 years ago, in every single country on planet Earth, where people believed that you had to work to get what you need. And we got to bring that trend back. And you got to understand it's fun. It's fun to do what you love for a living, which is why you must align your outsides with your insides. Think about the time you popped out of bed. You know, you pop out of bed in the morning when you're late for work and you're just nothing matters. It's like get enough clothes on, spritz up your body, do the French shower, right? Wipe yourself down, get to work. But think about when you got out of bed and when you love to do something that you love to do. And it might take a couple jobs to get to it, right? You might need to keep the job that you have to pay the bills, but you spend all your spare time at home working. Doesn't matter if you have kids, there is time in the day. Communicate with your family about what you need to do. Tell them you're going to lose an hour here and there, but do it from home so they get to see you, right? That way you're not gone from their social presence. You're just working and you're doing it for the family. It's a team effort. Daddy's going to go make more money. Mommy's going to make more money. Daddy's going to be more happy at least. Mommy's going to be more happy, right? And when your kids see that, it's going to be a great thing for you, right? Great thing for the whole family. You will have set an example that needs to happen. That's why, you know, even though you are on YouTube watching this, you know, we have to be careful with everything that we use as a spare time mechanism, right? You do need to be entertained. So definitely earmark some things in your life that are like, this is what I do to be happy. I know it's a waste of time, but it lets me relax. It doesn't matter what it is, right? As long as it's not hurting somebody else or burdening someone else, right? Communicate those things as well. Make choices. This is the best video game in the whole world. It's called life. It's not a rehearsal. You don't get another redo as this person. Even if there's reincarnation, right? You're starting from scratch. So you got to treat this particular one as the only game you get to play. You know, it's like Counter-Strike or paintball. When you die, you're out of the game. And you can come back in the next game, but you're sort of like all the dynamics are completely redone. Maybe there's age to the soul and wisdom to the soul that we don't know about. But until we have those things confirmed, this is your only shot, right? Just like Eminem said, right? That whole 8 Mile theme song, I forgot the damn name of the song, but man, is that song on it, man. He says, you got one shot to make it. And it's not actually true. You got multiple shots to make it, but each shot that you get is the shot that you have for that one opportunity. You know? And I wanted to say one other thing before I throw the whole bumper out there. For those of you who are inventors, for those of you who have big dreams, I'm going to tell you right now, go for those dreams. You know, you may not be able to quit your job and go 100% unless you have the cash to pull it off. But I'll tell you the one thing that I that has been the case in my life, my entire life, which is that I invent things. Like, I'll invent websites that do things that no one's ever done. I'll write scripts that no one asked me to write. And people will say, well, you know, someone's already doing that, so don't do that. Don't listen to them. Do it your way. Do it a better way. If Steve Jobs and Apple had listened to that train of thought, they would have never made the iPod, which made that company completely explode. And love him or hate him, it made them billions of dollars. It made them more money selling a little music player than it did selling the software, the hardware of all their computer systems, right? There were 35 players on the market when he made the iPod. More than that, most likely. I had one of the top of the line ones, and it was a giant piece of crap. I think it worked for maybe 4 or 5 uses, but it cost me over $100. They did it their way, and they made it better. They redesigned the telephone, right? They made the iPhone, and now it's a piece of crap, but they redesigned it completely from the bottom up, and now every phone is an iPhone. The Androids are iPhones. The Androids went a hell of a lot better, in my opinion. But anyway, they didn't listen. If somebody said, don't make a personal computer in the late 70s, I wouldn't be here today, right? So don't listen to that. Follow your dreams. If nothing else, it'll become an exercise in what you are good at, and you'll learn things in doing that. But the amount of products that I've created that have totally succeeded, either for myself or for other companies that I design the products for, there was always someone saying, usually, that's being done, or it's already been done, and I do it better than most people. I do, because I pay attention to all the elements of how the competition's doing it. And there's if the competition did it right, I guarantee you one thing would be true. I wouldn't want to do a duplicate. I wouldn't. I don't need to spite someone to make a product. The only reason why I feel like a product needs to be created is because I don't like all the alternatives that are out there. And if you have that feeling, then you know that too. You know? So just a little push, and hopefully in the right direction for you. Again, you'll learn something very, very valuable. And if you take, you know, what Edison supposedly made 10,000 light bulbs before he got vacuuming and you know, all the different elements of how thick to make the element inside of a bulb, it took him 10,000 tries to get it right. And next time you turn the light on in your room, think about Edison not listening to someone naysaying his idea. Okay, he was lucky that he was making something that didn't exist, but let me tell you, it's probably a little bit more difficult to make something that doesn't exist than to make a competitive product that does exist, right? You feel me? All right, this is rather a long one, but it's a very serious subject, and I want you guys to succeed. If you haven't been, go to mkultraradio.com. At the top are all the links. If you haven't subscribed already, please subscribe if you dig this. If you made it this far, you might as well subscribe because something's connecting with you, right? If you haven't liked the video, please like it. If you could do us a favor, and if you like any of the other videos and you forgot to push the like, I'm supposed to tell you to go down and click the little thumbs up button because that helps the organic search process in YouTube. I hate doing these kind of bumper things, but it's supposedly helping people out finding this stuff. There's not really much else to say. Learn the rules that rule you. Hopefully this gave you some of the rules that rule you, and you can start dominating your life. Be good to yourself, be good to someone else, and I'll meet you in the next episode. Over now.